Let's get on with this. I know you came to hear Jeremy Scahill, and I don't blame you. Now, it's not really important to me, and we didn't come together here because his book won the George Polk Award or the James Aronson Award for Social Justice Journalism. We didn't come to hear him speak because he's a reporter for Democracy Now! And a writer for The Nation. We didn't come to hear him because you pick up his book and look at the back and you see names like Bill Moyers, Naomi Klein, and Matthew Rothschild. We came because this is an authentic investigative journalist. And when he wrote the book, and now as he follows up this important book that some people will call controversial, he tells the truth. He's confronted in many times and places by people that have some strange ideas about how the world works, some strange theories about what makes the world tick and what makes it blow up and what makes it get back on course. And what he uses to guide himself is his own reporting, checking stories, checking facts. And then he has more than adequate capability of standing in front of people like you who are interested in what the truth is, and telling things as they are. And it's a great pleasure for me to introduce, in Spokane, Jeremy Scahill.
Thank you. Thank you. Wow, thank you for that warm welcome. It's a little bit warmer than the one I got talking to the 10 Blackwater guys who came to the talk in Coeur d'Alene last night. And I'm not kidding, they were about one out of every five people there was from Blackwater. But I have to say that they were respectful, not so much toward Rusty, who they interrogated, like he was holding the press conference at one point about his military record. But we'll get to that in a second. In addition to just thanking all of you for coming out here tonight and showing up on such a beautiful evening, I want to really thank Melanie Luters for that beautiful singing that she did and bringing us the music of both herself and Phil Oakes. Thank you so much, Melanie. And of course, the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane for making this possible. Rusty and Bonnie and the folks in both Spokane and Coeur d'Alene that brought me out here. I really appreciate it. And thanks to Mountain Gear for putting me up tonight and for the delicious dinner. I am going to talk quite a bit tonight about Blackwater and what I think is the threat that it poses to both U.S. democracy and global stability. But I want to make clear, it's not just Blackwater. And Blackwater didn't start the problems that we now are facing. Blackwater is fruit of a very poisonous tree, and ultimately that tree was built by those in power, not by Blackwater. And I'm going to explain what I mean by that in a moment. But before I get into Blackwater, I want to say a couple of broader picture things. I was in both Denver and St. Paul covering the Democratic and Republican national conventions. And I think those of you who've been following politics for a long time, or any of you who've been to one of these conventions, knows that much of what happens is pure show. But what is real are the demonstrations in the streets of those people who have the audacity to stand up in such dark times and say no, no to war, no to these economic policies, no to erosion of civil liberties, no to the targeting of dissent, and the shutting down of institutions of dissent in this country. And so, small as they were, groups of people from around the country descended on both of those cities. It was much smaller in Denver than it was in St. Paul, but modest protests, both of them. And yet, despite the fact that the protests were relatively small, the machinery that was deployed on the streets of both of those cities to face down against those who were simply expressing their right of freedom of speech and freedom of dissent was a massive security operation that was funded by the federal government alone to the tune of $50 million for each city. The federal government spent $50 million. Now, mind you, we're talking about the economic crisis in this country. We're talking about this socialism for Wall Street, this bailout that's being debated and discussed right now. And they found it in their budget somehow, with people struggling so deeply in this country to keep their homes, to keep food on the table for their families, to keep their families' heads above water. They found in the budget $50 million to give to the city of Denver to deploy a force of repression on the streets, and $50 million to give to the city of St. Paul to deploy a force of repression on the streets. They funded and then operated what they called a 24-hour fusion center in each of those cities, where they had representatives from every intelligence agency and every entity of the military and state, local, and federal law enforcement, and they were monitoring the protesters, monitoring the dissidents. And in Denver, when the Iraq Veterans Against the War, brave young men and women who were in Iraq and Afghanistan, have come back and are now fighting against the war, when they staged a protest in front of the Democratic National Convention asking to address the delegates and read their list of three demands, which consist of the following: immediate and unconditional withdrawal of all U.S. troops, mercenaries, and contractors from Iraq, adequate health benefits for veterans, and the payment of reparations to the Iraqi people. When they marched in their full military uniforms to the gates of the Democratic National Convention, the U.S. taxpayer dollars were used to face down against them under threat of tear gas. And at one point, two small cranes were brought in, almost like apple pickers or something the phone company would use, and they were raised above this crowd of veterans in uniform, and snipers were atop them, facing down at the crowds below, while security forces, as they're called, were dressed in these sort of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle outfits, these riot outfits, to face down against veterans who had nonviolently walked up and simply requested to address the Democratic National Convention at a time when this nation is facing a deepening catastrophe in Iraq and a deepening catastrophe in Afghanistan. And they were not allowed to go in and address the Democratic National Convention, and they were prevented from doing so by this massive security operation.
You're listening to a speech by Jeremy Scahill, the author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. The speech was recorded at the Bing Theater in Spokane on Tuesday, September 30th, 2008.
In St. Paul, we saw something that was on a whole new level. We saw the Republican National Committee preemptively allocate $10 million to the city of St. Paul to pay for the first $10 million in legal costs for the city to fight lawsuits brought for violation of human rights against protesters who came to St. Paul. The RNC gave a $10 million down payment on repression to the agencies, security agencies that were there operating on the federal payroll. And what we saw, in fact, when I got off the plane going from Denver to St. Paul, I was with Amy Goodman and others from Democracy Now!, and all of our phones started ringing because one of our journalists, Elizabeth Press, a producer of Democracy Now!, was being unlawfully detained in a home in St. Paul that had been raided as part of these preemptive raids that were happening of journalists and video activists who had come to St. Paul to document the human rights abuses that would take place in the streets. And so we all went. We didn't go anywhere to where we were staying. We all went straight to this neighborhood where a standoff was happening. You had the media outside. You had a house that had been raided by the Minneapolis police. And then you had neighbors and others standing around, and we weren't able to see what was happening inside because the police had blocked off the area, and we didn't know what was going on. We heard the initial call that men with guns drawn had come in and raided the house of the eyewitness video team. And then this amazing woman, African-American woman, comes out of her home next door to that house that had been raided, and she says to all the journalists and activists and others there, "Hey, y'all, they're holding them in the backyard next door. Everybody come through my house." And so we all... Yeah, we all ran through this wonderful woman's home And she allowed people with cameras to get on her garage and to stampede through her garden. And she was yelling, "This is supposed to be a free country." And she's yelling it at these police officers. Now, she's going to have to live with those police officers after everyone else goes home. But because of this woman's bravery in that moment to confront this police state, we all were able to go into the backyard of her house and film what was happening. And what was happening is that journalists were handcuffed, hands behind the back, in the backyard, and their only crime was that they had come there to document what was going to be happening in the streets. And because people showed up, and because the cameras were on them, and because this one woman allowed everyone into her backyard, they were forced to let all of those people go on the spot. That kicked off a series of unlawful detentions, stopping and frisking of people, seizing of computers, taking of cameras, arresting of journalists, over 80 media workers arrested, over 800 ordinary folks who had come there to protest, many of them who simply committed the crime of waiting to see a concert in a park on the streets on the outskirts of St. Paul. And what we saw here for protests that at their maximum numbered about 10 or 11,000 was this paramilitary operation deployed in the streets to protect what? To protect John McCain? To protect the Republican National Convention? You know, they had the flimsiest security I've ever seen at a convention, and I've been to all of them since 1996, at the Republican National Convention inside. Medea Benjamin from Code Pink was able to walk onto the stage while Sarah Palin was speaking, with her hand in the air like this. But you couldn't walk across certain streets near the delegate hotels outside because you'd be facing down against these stormtroopers that were deployed in the streets of a U.S. city. The reason I go into detail about this story is because what we are seeing clearly, and we've been seeing this increasingly, certainly since Seattle in 1999, is a paramilitarization of law enforcement in this country. We are seeing high-end military-type training, special forces and SWAT-type training being given to rank-and-file police officers who I think many could argue shouldn't even be carrying guns in some of the communities that they're patrolling. And instead, they're being given this paramilitary-type training, and that's one of the main areas of business for Blackwater. Blackwater in Coeur d'Alene, 40 miles from here, 35 miles from here, has purchased a company called The Backup, which my understanding, and this is what the Blackwater people told me last night, is the largest and the most successful video training company for law enforcement in this country. 30,000 officers a year are trained with their DVDs that they send around with classes and training techniques, etc. So Blackwater has now bought this company and is expanding its reach. In addition to what it's doing in Idaho, in your backyard, Blackwater trains 20 to 50,000 soldiers and police officers every year at its various facilities around the United States. Blackwater is cashing in on this trend of paramilitarization of law enforcement in this country, not to mention the tremendous amount of money that Blackwater has made off of the occupation of Iraq. Now, as we sit here tonight, we see that the Republican Party is in shambles for a number of reasons. One is the fact that the Sarah Palin cat is out of the bag. And I don't know if you've seen parts of this interview that Katie Couric did. It's like a mini series or something with Katie Couric and Sarah Palin. But I feel like it's like you're shaking the eight ball, and you never know which of the answers is going to pop up. You could do a sort of choose your own adventure with Sarah Palin. But also because of the economic situation, you know, the Republicans voted against this bailout that was being supported by the president, by John McCain, and by the leaders of the Republican Party. And so, you know, Barack Obama is probably sitting back and saying, let's just let these guys steer the ship for a little while. So they're in crisis. And there's no question that if the Republicans ran a head of lettuce for president, the head of lettuce would probably get the same number of votes as John McCain. In fact, the Republicans figured out a way to get a candidate that's slightly less charismatic than a head of lettuce to run for president. So I'm not so interested in talking specifically about John McCain because it's beating a dead horse. Maybe that's not the best analogy, but it's, we know. I mean, as Pat Buchanan said, John McCain could make Dick Cheney look like Gandhi. Okay, fine. Well, we'll leave it to Pat Buchanan to do the analysis there. But on the other side, we have Barack Obama. Now, what's happened with Obama's campaign is that we've seen over the past several months a fairly dramatic shift to the right in terms of his foreign policy vision, and some would say on the domestic agenda as well, because we've seen a replacement of the upper echelons of the Obama campaign, progressives out, and the old guard hawkish Democrats of the 90s that were the staples of the Clinton administration have been brought in. And we are seeing the Democrats once again gearing up for a sort of run to the right in terms of foreign policy. The Democrats have a PhD in losing elections. In 2000, when the election was stolen, Al Gore and his campaign refused to effectively fight it and then engaged in those scurrilous attacks on Ralph Nader, which were an absolute lie and ridiculous for anyone who was following it. In 2004, John Kerry tried to out-Bush Bush. In 2006, the Democrats finally take control of both houses of Congress and then proceed to swiftly win as their crowning achievement the lowest approval rating of any national body. Nancy Pelosi's top achievement as Speaker of the House was to get an approval rating lower than that of President Bush. And why? Why? Because they failed on every issue that was important to people in this country who believe in justice, on the illegal spying on people in this country. The Democrats back down and then turn around and have their convention sponsored by AT&T, one of the countries that was complicit in the spying. On the Patriot Act, the absolute failure to effectively challenge and repeal it because all of them voted for it except Russ Feingold. The fact that they failed to stop the funding of the illegal and immoral occupation of Iraq, and they failed to stop an escalation of the war in Afghanistan, on Afghanistan. The major principles in this society, not to mention civil liberties and the president's moves that he's taken to try to expand his ability to declare martial law and violate posse comitatus, the Democrats have stood down and done nothing. And so now we have Obama, a man who has inspired a great amount of hope, is the word that they use on the campaign trail, filling 85,000 seats in a stadium. I was there at an Invesco Stadium, and there were rock stars, and there was music, and Obama gave his big speech, and I felt like at times I was at a mass wedding or something, that we were all leaving there married or something. But I'm not saying all this to bash Obama. I'm saying it because it's not about Barack Obama. It isn't about who he is as a man. It's not about do we like him. You know, people say that was the mistake they made with Bush, the guy they'd want to have a beer with. I wouldn't want to have a beer with Bush. But people, they're getting into the cult of personality thing. Let's look at the policies and the politics going on right now. The Obama campaign does not have a plan to end the occupation of Iraq. They have a plan to downsize and rebrand the occupation of Iraq. Obama takes credit for calling for an escalation of the war in Afghanistan and saying that he wants to send more troops there and has criticized President Bush and John McCain for not following his lead. He has reserved the right to use unilateral preemptive force in Pakistan. He has adopted the rhetoric of the war on drugs, not just about this country, but also in targeting Latin America. Obama almost never talks about the poor and almost never mentions the word poverty. At the Democratic National Convention, The Hurricane Katrina and the U.S. Gulf was mentioned once by former President Clinton and only in two words, Katrina and cronyism. No one mentioned the war profiteers, Blackwater, Halliburton, KBR. It was a show. It was a concert. It was everything as it appeared on television. These are deadly serious times. I'm not saying this because I want to break off anyone's engagement to Barack Obama. Many of my friends are in love with him. I just want you to cheat on him with a little bit of conscience when it comes to the issues that are important to you. So as we move into this deeper into this economic crisis, why are none of the leaders of either parties, well, it's clear why the Republicans wouldn't, but why is no one from the Obama campaign making a direct connection between the economic crisis and the out-of-control spending on these wars of aggression abroad? The fact is that right now, and this segues us into a discussion of Blackwater and these mercenary companies. In Iraq right now, the United States is spending $2 billion a week occupying Iraq. A recent Congressional Budget Office report indicated that between 20 and 25% of the money being spent on the occupation of Iraq is going directly to for-profit corporations. They call them contractors. My sources in the Congress, which constitute high-ranking members of the House Oversight Committee, say that 40% of every dollar that's being spent on the war in Iraq is going directly to for-profit war corporations. Just so we can put this in a context here. Right now in Iraq, there are between 140 and 160,000 U.S. troops, American flags on their shoulders, deployed because they have to be there. There are 190,000 private contractors, as they call them, individuals working for for-profit war corporations. They work for a network of 630 corporations on the U.S. government payroll and draw their personnel from 100 countries around the world. Among this army of 190,000 contractors, which is now the biggest force in Iraq, bigger than the United States military, you have these armed mercenaries and armed contractors like those that work for Blackwater, Triple Canopy, and DynCorp, the three big U.S. firms. These individuals are paid substantially more than regular U.S. soldiers for their time spent in Iraq. Why is this not an absolute scandal in this country? I don't care if you're for or against the war on this issue. This should be an issue that should outrage everyone in this country. And I cannot understand why the Democrats did not take this to town until I look at the campaign contributions. There is almost an even split when it comes to defense industry dollars between the Democrats and the Republicans. Hillary Clinton was the number one recipient of defense industry dollars when she was running for president, of all of the candidates running for president. I'm not saying this to hammer on her. I'm saying it because the defense contractors and the defense industry, they were placing bets. They felt that the wind was blowing in the direction of the Democrats, and early on they thought Hillary was going to be the candidate, so they poured the money into her campaign coffers. Obama gets a tremendous amount of support from the defense industry. Perhaps that's why Senator Barack Obama says he will not support a ban on Blackwater. And his advisors told me that he cannot and will not rule out using Blackwater in Iraq if he is elected president. It's because Obama's Iraq Plan A necessitates the use of these forces. They're like the American Express card of the occupation. They can't leave home without them. Because he doesn't want to be portrayed as anti-defense industry, because that's major campaign cash. So the Democrats are also beholden to these corporations. What we have seen happen over the past 8 years in this country is an escalation of the most radical privatization agenda in the history of our country. We see it in schools, we see it in healthcare, we see it in prisons. It cuts into every aspect of our life. Life in this country is being radically privatized. 70% of the combined budget of the 18 intelligence agencies in this country is in the hands of private contractors. 70%. For-profit corporations with clients across the globe that span the course of Fortune 500 companies and foreign governments, for-profit companies are involved with the most sensitive gathering and presentation of intelligence every single day in this country, including the preparation of the single most important intelligence document produced every day in this country, the Presidential Daily Briefing. That was the document that said in August of 2001, bin Laden determined to attack America. Contractors are involved at every level of the intelligence apparatus while simultaneously working for foreign governments and for-profit corporations. What is to stop these companies from injecting intelligence into the national intelligence system that would benefit one of their clients or harm one of their competitors? It is a system that has gotten so out of control that it would require a completely different political system in this country to stop it. It's a cancer that has metastasized so quickly with such feverish bipartisan support that I fear that, short of overhauling the entire political system in this country, it's an unstoppable force.
You're listening to a speech by Jeremy Scahill, the author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. The speech was recorded at the Bing Theater in Spokane on Tuesday, September 30th, 2008.
Blackwater is one of the greatest beneficiaries of this system when it comes to the U.S. war machine, and it's a company that owes its livelihood and its existence to the growth of the military-industrial complex, but also to the wedding of the neoliberal and neoconservative visions and ideologies. It was a company that didn't exist about a decade ago. It was founded in 1997, 1998, and at the beginning, Blackwater was envisioned as a sort of sportsman's paradise, a place where gun enthusiasts could come and fire their weapons, do target practice, and then they also wanted to do law enforcement training. And at the early stages of Blackwater's existence, the literature indicated that the company wanted to take advantage of what it saw as an acceleration of government outsourcing of security and firearms-related training. And as the company built up, it would benefit from almost annual tragedies that took place. In 1999, it was the shootings at Columbine. Blackwater responded to those shootings by erecting a mock high school on their compound, and they called it RU Ready High, like the letter R, the letter U, and they invited law enforcement agents from around the country to come and train at Blackwater on how to face down against the violent youth of America's schools. In 2000, it was the bombing of the USS Cole off the coast of Yemen. The Navy responded to that by giving Blackwater a $35 million contract to train sailors in how to defend their ships and vessels from those kinds of attacks. But the real money for the company started pouring in after 9/11. Eric Prince, the secretive owner of Blackwater, seldom gave interviews at any point before last October. But he did give one interview right after 9/11, and you could probably guess the network he appeared on. It was Fox News, and he was on Bill O'Reilly's show. And Eric Prince was talking about the federal air marshal program and whether air marshals should be armed, and he said something that was interesting on that show. He said that he was starting to become cynical about how seriously people took the business of security and training. But after 9/11, he said, the phone has been ringing off the hook at Blackwater. And one of the first calls that came into Blackwater was from the Central Intelligence Agency. They contracted Blackwater to insert a small team of special forces operators inside of Afghanistan in the early stages of U.S. operations there, right along the Afghan-Pakistan border. That, by my analysis and research, was the first time that we saw Blackwater actually crossing the line from the campy atmosphere of a sportsman's paradise to being a mercenary company providing soldiers for hire to the U.S. government and other entities. When Paul Bremer was sent into Iraq in the summer of 2003 to be the overseer, the viceroy of Iraq, it wasn't the U.S. military that would be responsible for Paul Bremer's security. It was a private company, Blackwater, which was given a $27 million no-bid contract to be the elite bodyguards of the U.S. occupation. That kicked off the gold rush for these armed private security companies in Iraq. Blackwater sort of blew open the door for the rest of them. And it was stated in the Times of London that in post-invasion Iraq, i.e. occupied Iraq, the real boon is not oil, but is private security. It's the gold rush. And so daily pay for these individuals skyrocketed overnight and went from a few hundred dollars to over $1,000 a day per man. In some of the contracts that were being given out at that time. Within a year, Blackwater went from being a $27 million contractor with the Bremer security detail to $300 million a year just to protect the U.S. Occupation officials in Iraq. Blackwater's role in the so-called global war on terror was secured and began to expand to the point where Blackwater is now the largest armed private contractor in Iraq right now. It's the largest private force of armed individuals inside of Iraq. The Blackwater story, though, is certainly not just about Iraq. It's not just about the war, and it's not just about the training that I mentioned before. When I really started to get interested in this story was after the four Blackwater men were killed in Fallujah in March of 2004. And the reason that I've paid close attention to it is because I had spent a lot of time in Fallujah, and when Bush ordered the destruction of that city, I began investigating from a simple question. How on earth were the lives of those four men who were not U.S. soldiers and certainly not civilians, but working for a for-profit company, worth the destruction of an entire city, the inflaming of the Iraqi resistance, which ultimately resulted in scores of U.S. troops being killed? It really was the week that the war turned. And I started investigating the company, but then I went to New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. I got there right after the flooding of the city. And in early September of 2005, when there was no FEMA to speak of rescuing anyone or distributing any food, I encountered Blackwater operatives armed with M4 assault rifles on the streets of New Orleans. I was talking to two New York City police officers in the French Quarter, and a compact car pulled up next to us. Three very large men got out of it, dressed in all khaki, with bulletproof garb, M4 assault rifles, Glock 9 pistols strapped to their legs, and they came up to us and they said, "Where are the rest of the Blackwater guys?" And without skipping a beat, the New York police officers who were there as volunteers started to tell them where to go. And I sort of zoned out for a second because I couldn't quite believe that I was hearing what I was hearing. And they got in their car and they drove away. And I said to the police officers, Blackwater, you mean like the guys in Iraq and Afghanistan? And they said, yeah, they're all over the place down here. And I said, well, I would like to talk to them. Where are they? And the cops said, you can go either way on this street, implying they're everywhere. You know, like ants on candy down here. So I went a few blocks down and sure enough encountered a group of Blackwater guys on a corner. They were emptying out an apartment over a bar in the French Quarter, and they draped an American flag over the balcony on it. And I went up and started talking to them. And I said, you know, what are you guys doing down here? And they said, we're here to help. And I said, well, who sent you here? Our boss. And I said, well, who's your boss? And the one guy's like, Blackwater. And I said, but are you law enforcement? I mean, are you operating, you know, under some government authority here? Because those are pretty heavy weapons that you have. And one guy finally pulls out a gold badge, and he says, I was deputized by the governor of the state of Louisiana. I've been authorized to use lethal force if I deem it necessary. And he's saying this, and another guy was saying that their mission there was to confront criminals and stop looters. To confront criminals and stop looters. And someone mentioned something about a Department of Homeland Security camp. And I said, are you working for the Department of Homeland Security? And the guy said, well, it's way above my pay grade. So I started to investigate this further. Oh, by the way, one of them also said that he when they told him he was going to New Orleans, he had to ask what country was that in. And another guy said that there wasn't enough action there. I don't know about you, but when I see a guy who 2 weeks earlier was in Iraq, deployed on the streets of a city in my country, talking about there's not enough action here, it sent chills up my spine. And so I start digging into this story, and the federal government was denying that it had hired any private security forces. A number of reasons for the denials. One, at that time, guns were being taken away from people in New Orleans at a time when mercenaries were deploying there from other areas of the United States. But two, where was the Louisiana National Guard when the people of Louisiana actually needed them? They were deployed in Bush's wars abroad. And so for the Bush administration to admit that they had hired a politically connected mercenary company to deploy in a disaster zone because the National Guard wasn't there, would have been a damning admission in a sea of them at the time, or a sea of damning omissions, more appropriately. And I dug and dug and eventually was able to obtain contracts that showed that Blackwater had been hired by the Department of Homeland Security through the Federal Protective Service, and they billed U.S. taxpayers $950 per man per day to operate in the hurricane zone. The guys on the ground told me they were being paid $350 a day. Blackwater billed $950 a day. $73 million Blackwater made off of its Hurricane Katrina operations just from the federal government. That doesn't count the work that they did for private individuals or wealthy business owners. So Blackwater made $70 million. And when the Department of Homeland Security was forced to do a review of this contract after the reporting we did in The Nation and Cynthia McKinney and others held hearings on it, the Department of Homeland Security determined that it was the best value for U.S. taxpayers. Now, I don't know if any of you went down there at the time to help, but I saw the systematic humiliation of people being forced to take showers in these makeshift showers set up outside of stadiums in Baton Rouge and New Orleans, people being humiliated in front of their children, called looters because they were neglected and abandoned, and they had the audacity to walk into a convenience store and take some food out of the convenience store. But and then they were given these ATM cards by FEMA that didn't work. And then they would try to go and get them, and they'd have to wait in sweltering hot heat in line. And the best value to taxpayers at the time was to pay Blackwater $950 per man per day to what? Walk around with guys who were shell-shocked, PTSD, wielding M4 assault rifles and Glock 9s, complaining that there's not enough action there? But you know what? That's not even the scariest aspect of this story. And this is something that I actually didn't find out until after the book came out. Eric Prince, the owner of Blackwater, decided before the hurricane had actually hit, that he was going to send 180 of his men, armed and with a Puma helicopter, onto the streets of a U.S. city with no government authority whatsoever. A private individual in this country decided that he was going to define who were looters and who were criminals and who needed to be faced down against by his men from Blackwater with their M4 assault rifles. They were there a week before they were hired by the federal government. It was disaster profiteering, but it also says something about the state of the Constitution in this country and about posse comitatus and about the deployment of military forces on U.S. soil. Just because someone is a former Navy SEAL or a former Delta Force guy or used to be in the U.S. Army and now works for a private company and deploys on the streets in a military or paramilitary style operation, that to me is a violation of the spirit of the Posse Comitatus Act. Those guys have no business being deployed on the streets of U.S. cities. I also encountered Israeli commandos who were operating an armed checkpoint in front of a private gated community on St. Charles in New Orleans, and I interviewed them and talked to them, and they were from a company called Instinctive Shooting International, ISI. I wish it was a joke. They had been flown in from Galveston, Texas, where they were based. These are Israeli commandos who had participated in the invasion of Lebanon. They were flown in by helicopter from Galveston, Texas, to a park across the street from this gated community, and then proceeded to set up sniper positions on the roofs of the mansions, and were operating a checkpoint where they were stopping U.S. citizens on the streets of their city with guns. They were stopping them and asking them questions and telling them they had to turn around, they couldn't go this way in a private gated community. New Orleans was a window into the future in this country, a window into what can happen in national emergencies with natural disasters. We see what the rich can do. The rich can fly in their Israeli commandos by helicopter. The wealthy will be evacuated out of their homes and taken somewhere safe while the mercenaries stay and guard their properties and their businesses. The poor will be neglected and left to fend for themselves and deal with what crumbs fall off the table of social services in this country or disaster response services, but the rich are going to be fine. That's how the system is working now. If you're a dissident, you face down against a $50 million apparatus of repression when you go to Barack Obama's convention or John McCain's convention. If you're rich, you get bailed out, like is going to happen now on Wall Street. That's the country that we now are living in. You know, people used to say that I don't want this to turn into that kind of country. It is that kind of country. We have now crossed a threshold where the corporations are now in total control. This is now a corporatist society. And part of the reason that I spent so much time at the beginning talking about the policy platforms of Barack Obama is that I think that Obama represents a status quo for the system in this country. He's going to always defend the corporate power of the United States and will strike with the iron fist of U.S. militarism when corporate interests are at stake. He's made that abundantly clear. And so when we're in times such as these, it's not about what you do or who you vote for on November 4th. It's what do you stand for right now and what are you going to stand for on November 5th? Because we are in a major crisis in this country, beyond the economic crisis, beyond the situations in Iraq and Afghanistan with our civil liberties. We are in a fight right now. And if you don't understand this, wake up, please. We are in a fight right now for the future of this country. The very fabric of democracy is at stake right now. And until we wake up and rattle the cage of this two-party system, until we have the audacity to be people who actually do take to the streets, nothing is going to change for the better. Things are going to continue to change for the worse. I'm not a Democrat or a Republican. I'm a journalist. And I believe that in this country, as the situation gets worse, it's going to be less and less important whether you fall under the banner of the elephant or the donkey, because it's our future in this country that's at stake. And so we look at what's going to happen if Obama's president or McCain's president. There's going to still be an occupation of Iraq. There's going to be an escalation of the war in Afghanistan. There's going to be the posturing toward Iran. There's going to be torture being committed in our names by U.S. forces and their contractors around the world. There's going to be an upholding of repressive laws like the Patriot Act. There's going to be a continuation of a system that gives corporations human rights while ours disappear. All of these problems are going to exist whether the Democrats are in power or the Republicans are in power. The challenge to us now is to stand up against those who truly wield power in this country, the Blackwaters of the world, the Triple Canopies, the DynCorps, the KBRs, the Halliburtons, the Lehman Brothers, the AIGs, all of these companies. That's where power lies in this country. And so looking beyond the election and who's president, We need to build a movement that takes the resistance to those who actually are in charge, those who run the corporations in this country, those that profit off the misery of others. And that's why I salute what a tiny group of people are doing in Coeur d'Alene. That's why I salute the people of Potrero, California, who ran Blackwater out of town, the people in Illinois who are standing up against them, the people that are starting to do it in North Carolina, those that have taken on Bechtel and Halliburton. They're the ones that understand where the real power is in this country, and they're the ones that have begun the fight to retain some semblance of democracy in our society. Thank you very much. Thank you.
You've been listening to a speech by Jeremy Scahill, the author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. The speech was recorded at the Bing Theater in Spokane on Tuesday, September 30th, 2008.